Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill.
Okay, welcome to another episode of the Plant Cunning Podcast. Today we have herbalist and author Lucy Jones on the show, and it's a wonderful conversation. I'm sure you're going to love it. Before we get to it, I just want to remind folks that we are having a in-person conference here at our farm in central New York on September 9th and 10th. And if you would like to come, you can follow the link below to get your early bird tickets. Those are going to go up in price in July, so make sure you get them now because there are also only a limited number of tickets available. Okay, here's Lucy.
We're very excited today to welcome Lucy Jones to the Plant Cunning Podcast. Hi, Lucy. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you. Very excited to be here.
Yes, it's so exciting to have you. I was just mentioning in the pre-chat that I've been following your journey on Instagram and I've been reading your books. Well, your first book, you just wrote another book, which you're really excited to dive into. And so it's a real honor and joy to get to actually just chat with you today.
It's mutual.
So you're an author and you're an herbalist. We have a traditional first question on the Plant Cunning Podcast, and it's how did you come to the plant path? So if you want to start there, we'd love to hear.
Great. And, you know, I'm really glad that I had an idea that you might ask me that. And it made me think about it. And what I actually realized is that I do have an answer, kind of like, you know, how I came to study and all of that, which I will go into. But I realized that looking back, it might sound a bit weird. I just think I was always on that because I was always on the plant path in a way, because I'm thinking like my earliest memories as a little kid, you know, I was always in the garden, you know, with the plants, really fascinated. And I just think, probably, although it depends how you define the plant path, doesn't it? But I just feel like in a way, without wanting to sound too, I don't know what the word would be, you know, I just feel like I was always on it, you know, practically, yeah. Maybe not from birth, but, you know, as soon as I was old enough to get outside, you know, I just knew that I wanted to work with plants. And maybe I didn't know the exact form that would take. But yeah, I think you could say they called to me. Or they ordered me, I don't know, but I'm so happy that that happened. And so to answer your question properly, how do I answer that properly? Well, I think I always wanted to work with plants, as I've just said, but I was maybe a bit reticent about going down the medical herbalist route, even though it's what I really wanted to do when I was younger. I think that I was quite academic, and I think there was some sort of pressure that I felt that maybe, you know, I should have a more, I don't know, conventional sort of career or something like that. But in my spare time, I was just really obsessed with herbs. And when I remember, actually, when I was at secondary school, we had this system where if you won the class prize, you would get a book token, and then, you know, you could choose what book you had. And I think there was a kind of unwritten understanding that it was going to be something like the Oxford English Dictionary or Shakespeare or something, and I chose a herbal. So I think I was always kind of really drawn to it, but when it came down to it, I studied agriculture and forestry to start with.
That's cool.
Which I really loved. It was so fascinating to learn about the growing side and, you know, soil science and all of that. I absolutely loved it and worked as a consultant for quite a while. But just the whole idea of herbal therapeutics, you know, all I ever wanted to do was just grow medicinal herbs and make stuff out of them. And so I think it was just an inevitable thing. And so there came a point when I'd been doing environmental consultancy for quite a while, which was quite a pressurized sort of job, which I also love. But there kind of came a point where you think, no, I really am going to pursue my passion instead of doing something that interests me and I enjoy. But I just felt this sort of destiny. And at that time, my spiritual teacher. I'm a Tibetan Buddhist, and I met my spiritual teacher, Akon Rinpoche, in 1993. And at that time, there was this very exciting proposal going on where a Tibetan master was going to be brought over from Tibet, a very high medicinal teacher, a professor and lineage holder called Kenpo Truro Tsenam. And it was a really amazing opportunity where a small group of Westerners were going to be taught the entire transmission of the Tibetan medicinal teachings. And we were very lucky because although all the teaching was going to be in Tibetan, it was, you know, it was going to be, we were going to have access to translators, and it was all really amazing. But it was, the course was very limited. You couldn't just join. And it was designed for people that were already working in a healthcare modality. So there were, you know, there were a couple of GPs, midwives, there were Reiki practitioners, Chinese medicine people, you know, all like across the board of people that were involved in healing. And there was me like, no, I'm an environmental consultant.
Wow.
I wasn't involved in healing, but I'm like, wow, did I really want to be on that course? So I asked my spiritual teacher, like, oh, please, can I join the course? And he said, no. So I was really a bit like, oh, this isn't how we do. Oh, I really want to do it. So I thought, okay, well, I was a bit gutted. I don't know. I thought that because it felt like I should do it, you know, maybe I asked in a way that perhaps wasn't, I don't know. Who knows? But anyway, he said no. And then about maybe a month later, I requested another interview with him. And I just said, look, I really, you know, I'm really asking. I really like to join the course. I feel that, you know, it would be really a great thing to do. And I'm very passionate about it. And please, will you let me join the course? And he said, no. I can't tell you how gutting that was, because it just felt so, the more that I wasn't able to do it, the more I felt like, I know that I'm meant to do this course.
Yeah.
You know, I just have this huge burning sort of thing. And also, as a side issue, I'd met another Lama, a very amazing Lama, and I had asked him to do a divination about whether or not I should study Tibetan medicine. And it was a whole, don't worry, I won't go into it, but it was a whole amazing experience. And he'd sort of done this divination. He said, you should definitely study Tibetan medicine, and you should definitely give up your job and do it. Yeah. So I think because he'd said that, I was thinking like, yeah, I mean, this is how the story goes, you know, like he's done that divination. He thinks that I should do it. So therefore, surely like I'm going to be able to do the course and it will all work out. But there was this, no. So I thought, well, maybe I'm not supposed to do that course. Maybe I'm supposed to do another one. But finally, I've been reading some various Tibetan stories and, you know, folklore and tradition about saints. And there is a big tradition about asking three times and showing, you know, real commitment. And I sort of thought, maybe this is it. Maybe, you know, maybe I need to ask a third time.
Yes.
So and it was really quite nerve-wracking, because I also decided that, of course, if he says no again, that's it. I'm not going to embarrass myself, you know, by doing it or put him to that trouble. So I'm going to ask the final time, the third time.
Yeah.
And I was so scared that, you know, what was going to happen. So I went in and I asked, and I just said, you know, I talked about how it just felt like my destiny. I felt like that I needed to work with the plants in this way. I felt so drawn to it, and I understood what an incredible opportunity it was to learn with this great master, and that I'd really appreciated that, and that I would do anything if I would be allowed to do it, because I felt so strongly about it. He said, well, he said, you could join the course if you commit to studying and qualifying as a Western herbalist when you finish the course. So that was a 4-year course already. And then to become a registered medical herbalist in the West was for me, it was a 6-year journey. But he said, you could do that if you commit to qualifying as a herbalist, and if you then commit to putting that knowledge together so that you can open a clinic that combines Tibetan medicine with Western herbal medicine. And if you commit to that, I will let you do the course. And here I am.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. So you're sitting in your herbal apothecary dispensary now?
Yeah. And this is why it's called Mirobalan Clinic, because Mirobalan is it's really the most sacred herb in the Tibetan pharmacopoeia. And I wanted, although no one can pronounce it, I don't mind. I just wanted something that reflected that link, because I am pretty much really working as a Western herbalist. I'm never going to say that I'm a Tibetan doctor, but the aim of this teaching that this few group of Westerners went through, a few, that's not the right grammar, but you know what I mean. The aim was so that we could bring the principles of Tibetan medicine and all of that incredible wisdom into a sort of a Western modality and be able to influence the work in a way. And I think I really, of course I'm going to say this, but I think that it is a very beautiful combination. Mm. So yeah, and I'm sitting here and I'm so happy that I've been able to fulfill that commitment. But it was quite a lot of studying.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah. What was studying with Kenpo Churo Sonam like? Like, what was he like?
It was really amazing. I think we were reminded at the beginning of every session that, you know, we weren't just there to learn what he was teaching us. He said, before we start this today's session, I want you to visualize that every word that I say and every piece of knowledge that you gain, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, it will be for the benefit of all beings, and that you can place yourself into that kind of state of learning for that benefit, you know. And it was a really amazing experience. It was very friendly and relaxed as well, but we were really conscious of it wasn't just a lecture and, you know, just taking notes. It was like this kind of incredibly important transmission, really, of much more than just, you know, what was on the page, I suppose. It really was an amazing, I think I only really appreciated how amazing it was as time went on, probably. I mean, you know, human nature, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, and also maybe comparing it to then your training as a Western herbalist. I wonder how that integration was for you. Like, because I see this happening. Like, I'm studying Vedic astrology now because I've been studying Western, and it's very different in Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine and traditional Tibetan medicine. There's a cohesiveness, and there's an underlying spiritual viewpoint that we don't have in the West, because mm-hmm. our traditions have been, you know, destroyed for the most part, and we're rebuilding them now. But I think having that perspective can be very helpful in navigating this reconstruction and revitalization of the Western traditions. But so how was your experience with that, with navigating that and the, you know, differences between the systems?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's different aspects to that question, but I think firstly, I was going into the Western studies as being a different subject, you know, that I'm learning this and then I will be able, hopefully, to integrate it in some way. Maybe I didn't know at the time. But I think that at the very beginning, I was quite keen to find a way of understanding the Western information in terms of the old Galenical humors and things like that. I thought, you know, maybe there'll be some crossover and I can kind of understand it, but no. it doesn't work. You know, the humors just don't match with the Tibetan ones. And so after years of trying to sort of, sanguine is moist and this, but in Tibetan medicine, air is dry. And, you know, and I thought, but, you know, maybe you can. And then I realized, just forget that. It's a different system. I was tying myself in knots trying to make them fit.
Yeah.
And what I realize now is that it's all about, I mean, I will admit that when I see a patient, I am probably primarily looking at them in terms of Tibetan medicine, in terms of their health narrative, in terms of the humors and the elements, because it's just so deeply taught, you know, that so I'm going to look at them on that, on look at a patient on that kind of elemental level, but then also look at them on a Western, more kind of maybe, you know, diagnostic type level, you know, what's the system, what physiological actions are needed. And for that, I'm much more, have a tendency to work with the Western herbs. But it's just this, I think it really works well, because when you're talking to patients about elemental balances and, you know, well, in Tibetan medicine, I would consider your case to be one of the air humor being in excess, and that means this, that, and the other. And people really get it, because it's a really simple sort of narrative, and it just makes a lot of sense. And also, particularly when people have not had answers from their allopathic practitioners and they're told, oh, just take antidepressants, you know, you're anxious or something. And it's just really helpful if you can explain why the air humor, the types of behaviors that have led to the air humor becoming in excess, you know, that person's been drinking a lot of green smoothies and having a lot of raw food and eating irregularly and not sleeping properly. And, you know, all of that has led to this kind of lack of groundedness. And, you know, that the person can really see that, and they can see like, hey, yeah, I'm not being dismissive about antidepressants, by the way. Can I just say that some people need them and that's fine. Please don't not have them if you need them. but you know, it is that stock kind of thing, isn't it? Oh, that a doctor may say if they don't really know what's wrong with someone. And I think that to empower a patient that they understand that they maybe need to change their lifestyle, change their diet, eat more regularly, eat more nourishing foods, go to bed a bit earlier, you know, all of that can work wonders alongside a Western prescription. I'm very passionate about it.
Yeah, totally.
Did you have a question? Or?
Well, I think it's an important point, though, when you're learning the systems, is that they're kind of like languages, and you can't just mix and match them, you know. But once you master each language, you can integrate them in a different sort of way.
That is such a good way of putting it. I love that. I agree. And also, I do think there's a danger of, I know that some people sort of said to me in the early days, like, oh, you know, if you're integrating the two, you could be diluting such a pure lineage as the Tibetan medicinal one. And, you know, what do you think you're doing? And actually, I've been saved from that, because I'm thinking I'm doing what my spiritual teacher asked me to do.
Right.
So I never felt insecure about it, because I had that really clear directive. I mean, I don't think I ever did say to anybody, I'm doing what my spiritual teacher asked me to do. But in my head, I'm thinking, you know, I understand why people might say that. I really get it. And I think there is a danger of diluting things and kind of mixing it all together. And so I love that idea of the two languages. Thank you for that.
Well, I've been thinking about this a lot because studying the different systems of astrology, which are very different. Another metaphor I like is painting. You know, you have oil paints, you have watercolors. You're not going to use the same techniques for both, because there's an internal consistency to each system. But the other thing is, so from my understanding, Tibetan medicine is already a synthesis of Ayurveda and Chinese medicine, and then also the native Tibetan. The Bon tradition. So, well, is that true?
Yeah, I think it is. But I think that Tibetan medicine is Buddhist medicine. And that's perhaps, you know, an underlying thread or bigger than a thread, you know, a current. And I think, yes, there's definitely crossover with Ayurveda, and many of the herbs from TCM are in the pharmacopoeia. And of course, you know, there's a lot of knowledge share and enriching. And with the traditional Bon system that's also integrated into it, you know, there's this fascinating teachings about spirit possession and appreciation of local land deities and how to read somebody's pulse when they're not present and all of that. I love that side of it, you know, really, really fascinating.
Yeah.
And we have all of that interwoven in a very logical and beautiful way. But the underlying thread is this, you know, this feeling or this teaching that until it's considered that in Tibetan medicine, no one can be truly, truly healthy and balanced until they accept that they are not separate from the outer environment in which they live. They have to really understand that interplay between themselves and the outside. And, you know, with my patients, look, I'm not going to go straight in with like, look, you know, you need to reach enlightenment to be well. But I just think it's a really wise teaching that there will always be an element of vulnerability to imbalance and illness until we kind of feel, you know, maybe we're not enlightened, but, you know, until we feel quite grounded and understand how the environment and ourselves is a sort of, it's a continuum, you know, and we are influenced by it. I just think that's so wise.
I think it's especially important for Westerners who their fundamental perspective often is being a separate, isolated entity that has, you know, has no interaction. I mean, there's the outside world doesn't influence me. I am my own, you know, person.
I
influence it. It's a passive substrate for me to assert my will into. But you know, it's even looking at in language of science, like we are not separate, like the environmental influences are always present and there's no way to really separate the air we breathe, the food we eat, everything is interconnected. So I think, and it's very, you got to know that if you want to heal, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? And I find that's the thing I suppose about herbalism is that when there's this kind of, I don't know if using the word alchemy is the right one for what I'm going to say, but there's this interplay between the practitioner, the patient, and the herbs, right? And it's different every time because we are all interconnected. And so with some patients, you know, you can get onto these sort of discussions. But with others, like they're not really going to be very comfortable with that. And we're going to keep everything at a really nice level of physiological healing. But over time, you know, I mean, I've got a patient, I really love her, you know, but she is an allopathic professional. I do treat the odd GP, hospital consultant, neurologists, anaesthetives, midwives and things, not hordes, let's get that in perspective, but that, you know, it happens. Anyway, this particular patient, she's very lovely. And there's always a good discussion when someone's from a sort of allopathic modality. But when we first started, I think I've seen her about 5 or 6 times now, and we're kind of getting to know each other a lot more. But when she first started, it was very matter of fact, like, I want you to fix me, and that's all there is to it. And last time she was here, I didn't even say anything to her. I did not talk about any of this stuff, but I did put Angelica in her prescription.
Oh.
and last time she said, oh my God, I am just feeling so much more grounded, and I'm really thinking about, I'm starting to think things like, what is my destiny? I really want to fulfill my destiny. Oh, that was the Angelica. Definitely. She's so happy. She's like listening to spiritual podcasts and things. And I promise you, I did not influence her in any way other than her prescription.
Angelica might have influenced her.
I think it was the Angelica. Yeah, I mean, and it wasn't even really in there for that reason. It was just, it was definitely justified physiologically. But when she came in and kind of quite out of character started talking about finding her destiny and listening to spiritual podcasts, I thought, I think that's probably the Angelica.
That's so cool. I love hearing, you know, stories from your practice. And I was actually wondering, like, we talk about treating people holistically as herbalists, and I was wondering what that means to you and what that looks like for you in your practice. Like, how do you incorporate your knowledge and incorporate the person and the herbs? Like, I'd love to just hear you riff on that a little bit.
Oh, well, yeah. It was one of my favorite subjects. But I think, well, I will preface it by saying that I think that in my practice and many herbal practices in the West, I think we are generally dealing with chronic conditions. I think, you know, the very different rules apply to acute conditions. So I know that there are some herbalists working in acute care, and my comments do not apply in that situation, because if someone comes in and they've got like a serious wound, bleeding or something like that, you just got to treat them, fix it, you know, that it's a completely different way of looking at it, really.
That's a good point.
But when you're dealing, you know, my patients are people who the healthcare people may, the allopathic people may not be able to help them anymore, or they've not got the answers that they want. So they're kind of like cases that have been going on for a really long time. They've been through lots of investigations. They're disheartened. They don't know if they're going to get better. They've also become quite accustomed to being ill. And sometimes that is part, that feels like part of their, almost like their personality, that they've, that it's been with them for so long. It's hard for them to imagine a life when they're not an ill person, you know. So there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of layers that need to be unpicked. But my way of looking at it is that I think the human body is absolutely amazing at fixing itself. And but what we have to do is act as a detective to find out what are the things that are preventing this human body from getting itself back into balance, because it's far wiser than, you know, I could ever be. But what I can do is pretty common sense, really, is find out by talking to them. And I do a 2-hour initial consultation. I ask people every single thing that they eat and drink as a general rule every day, with timings. I ask them, you know, when they go to bed, when they get up, what hobbies they have, you know, what brings them joy. You know, I really want to get to know them. But the point at which I ask people about a typical day of everything they eat and drink in chronological order, it's very revealing. And, you know, you can get to a situation where, for example, I had a patient who had not slept properly for 20 years, and she'd been prescribed sleeping pills from her doctor, and, you know, they were not really working. She felt awful. She had no energy. She was in a terrible state. And when I went through her intake, when it came to the things that she ate and drank every day, she was drinking 20 cups of coffee a day.
20?
You know, she had been prescribed sleeping pills. I'm not saying that was the only reason, by the way. There were other reasons, but just as a massive, nobody had ever asked her. And yet she'd been prescribed sleeping pills for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's hard, isn't it, for allopathic practitioners. They don't have long, they can't go into it in the depth that as a herbalist can. But I think my job, I feel, as a with a holistic approach, is to find those areas which can be fixed, and then and support the patient with herbs as well. But unless you're really trying to understand why something has happened, I don't think it's going to be so easy to fix it, really, because the patient has to understand, like, oh, maybe it's not such a great idea to drink 20 cups of coffee. And by the way, no water ever.
No, that's a real problem. Yeah.
So, you know, and it's like, so when students ask me, what is your advice to somebody that's going to become a medical herbalist? What advice can you give them? What advice can you give me? And they, I think they asked that because they think that I'm going to say something like, learn your herbs thoroughly, you know. And,
okay, yeah.
And I just say, have really good powers of persuasion. Because that example that I've given you, if I'd have just given her some sedative herbs, it was never going to work. And I don't do that because I also feel quite strongly that I don't want people coming into my clinic and then going out and saying, well, I tried that and it didn't work. And I just want to clarify, it's not like a me thinking I don't want them to say that about me. Right. I don't care about that. If they think that I'm rubbish, I honestly don't care. What I do care about is them thinking, I tried herbal medicine and it didn't exactly. work. It's exactly. the herbs. I don't want the herbs to be disrespected by people who are taking them in a way that is never going to work. So as a sort of loyalty to them, I want them to have the best chance of doing their job. So if that means persuading someone to have, you know, fewer cups of coffee, to drink more water, maybe to give up certain foods for a short time, I will do that. And I'm famous for, in my drop-in clinic, I'm really famous for not giving people stuff. They come in and people say, oh, can I buy something for my acid reflux? And I said, well, I'm afraid I can't sell something like that without I know, you know, I need to know a bit more about what's going on. And I asked them, you know, so what are you eating and what are you drinking? And if I think that that could be contributing to it, you know, or they're not having any water. And I said, well, I think the first thing to do before I prescribe you any herbs would be for you to drink a proper amount of water and maybe have less alcohol and do that. No, I'm not going to change. I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah.
I think, well, I'm not going to sell you anything then.
Yes. Totally.
Because it's false, isn't it? I mean, you could say, oh, that's really mean, that person's suffering, but that's the difference between a chronic and acute. If somebody is in an acute situation and they've got terrible heartburn, of course, like, I'm going to give them something. But if it's like a chronic thing, why prescribe herbs in a way that they can't fulfill their destiny to help people? They've given themselves up as agents of healing, and it's up to us to make sure that they have the best chance of making a difference. And that, to me, that's holistic care, because if you treat the root cause as best as you can, those herbs can make an incredible difference, life-changing.
Absolutely. And speaking of the, you know, the respect of the herbs as individuals, you do write and talk a lot about how something happens when you harvest your own medicine and when you grow your own herbs and gather your own herbs. And that's a shift in perception from herbs as tools to herbs as individuals. And you're writing a whole book. You wrote a whole book about that actually coming up. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that shift in perception.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it really seeps into you, because I think the first stage of it is that if you've grown a lot of calendula, for example, such a beautiful plant, and you know, and you've picked all these lovely sunny flowers, and you've kind of, you know, sometimes when we're picking them, we're quite sad, aren't we? Because they, you know, they look so beautiful. You're thinking like, oh, sorry, but you're going to be medicine. You know, you're going to help people. You kind of find yourself feeling like that about it. And you feel like they, in a way, they sort of offer themselves like, yeah, it's okay for you to take all my flowers because you're going to really, you know, put them to such a great way of helping people. It's really going to be amazing. So anyway, so you pick all these calendula flowers and you lay them out and you dry them, and after you've done all of that, are you really going to prescribe them to someone that's sort of saying, well, I'm not gonna change my life, I just want to take the herbs, just sell me the herbs, I'll pay you the money and let me see if it fixes my, you know, whatever it is. You sort of care, don't you? You've built yeah. that relationship with them. Whether or not you went into it with those sort of ideals of like, oh, you know, I'm going to grow these herbs for that reason. Just on a really practical level, you've put all that effort into it. You don't want them to be wasted, right? And then I just think it gets under your skin. And the more that you do it, you feel like, hang on, there's a bigger issue going on here. Because herbal medicine is such a huge industry. You know, there's so many supplements, and there's the risk of some herbs being over harvested, like slippery elm, for example, and different things. Golden seal, you know, there are people out there who just take golden seal every day because it manages their, you know, gut overgrowth and things like that. And it's just not okay, is it? Like, if we just respected the herbs as individuals and made sure that they were prescribed as best as we can, you know, like as far as possible, prescribe them in ways that they can make a difference and not be wasted, then that's going to be more sustainable, I think. I mean, I've got a patient who, she's not actually a patient now, and I'll tell you why. She's an amazing lady, and she actually got a taxi to come and see me because she didn't drive, and it's not, yeah, I guess you could get here on the train, but you know, where she lived, she had to get a taxi that was approximately an hour's journey. So she would pay for this taxi an hour, come here, have her consultation, and then, you know, pay the guy while he waited. And then, you know, so she was really committed to coming. She spent a lot of resources getting here, and she had acid reflux. And I went through her case, and it turned out that, you know, she snacked on cheese a lot of the time, and I haven't got like a massive issue about cheese, but you know, she had some symptoms to suggest that her digestion wasn't coping with it very well. So I suggested that she cut that out. And she also would have like wine every night before she went to bed. You know, there were a few kind of things that I was thinking, like, let's change that. If you've got acid reflux, let's change some of those things and help heal it. And obviously as well, part of that was supporting her digestion, because acid reflux, you know, you need to kind of gently increase the digestion as well, so that it doesn't sit in your stomach for so long. I mean, that's the whole topic. So I got, you know, I sort of said, look, do this, you know, drink chamomile tea to help boost the bitter intake, but it's also nice and calming. And I'm going to give you some slippery elm pills to help you in the short term while you make these changes. And so she came back, you know, all in her taxi for an hour, and she came back again, and she'd been taking the slippery elm, and she said, oh, I feel so much better. I haven't had any acid reflux over the last month, and I'm really delighted. So I said, oh, that's great. So let's carry on with it for another month, and then we'll start reducing it because you won't need it anymore. So she had it again for the next month, and she'd always given me the impression that she'd been taking my advice. But when it came to, like, after a few, she kept saying, oh, no, I don't want to reduce. Whenever I try to reduce the pills, it comes back again. So I was just being like, oh, she's quite old, and, you know, she's very nice, and she's coming in the taxi all this way. I don't want to be too harsh on her. So, you know, I said, well, yeah, but, you know, honestly, it's not really that sustainable for me to keep giving it to you if it's not working. So, you know, and it turned out that she loved having the slippery elm because she could still have her wine. She could still have all her cheesy snacks before bed. And she hadn't actually felt the need to change any of it because she was just taking my pills. So I said, look, that's not okay, because it's a scarce herb. It's endangered. And what you're thinking is that I could just carry on supplying you with these pills for the rest of your life so that you can carry on doing what you want. And she went, yeah, exactly what I think. And which, that's how people think when it's an allopathic drug, isn't it? Like, that's in our nature to expect, well, I'm paying this person, I'm paying for a taxi, I want their pills, they should surely be grateful for my business and sell it to me. But I just said, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. So unless you're prepared to at least start to change your lifestyle, I just can't supply you anymore. And so she and I parted company.
Wow. Yes.
But I didn't sort of just sack her straight away. I gave her the opportunity, but it didn't feel like, to me, that does not feel like I'm serving the herbs to enter into that kind of relationship? Because once you've started that, like, do you in 5 years' time suddenly say to her, look, no, sorry. I like, you can't. You've started it off, haven't you? You can't let someone down. But I think that at that beginning, when I still had that, it was still malleable enough for me to explain, look, this is the deal. Like, you get yourself better, and, you know, maybe you'll only need them for occasional times when you've, you know, been out with your friends or something, but you shouldn't be having to take them every single day just so that you can carry on with something that's making you ill. So I'm not, you know, to me, it's bigger than my sales of something. I'm not, you know, that's not my primary kind of motivation, I suppose. And at the beginning, when I was first qualified, when I'd done all my, you know, studying Tibetan medicine and then studying Western herbal medicine and opening my clinic, I was so excited. And I thought, you know, I'm going to finally be using herbs to help people get better. Mm-hmm. And after about a year or so, that didn't feel the right way to describe it for me. I mean, language is very powerful. So I started to think, oh, okay, using, I know lots of people say it is in our language, but to me, it feels a bit more exploitative in a way. So I started to sort of try and think, oh, this is me. I'm now I'm working with them to help people get better. But after, you know, now I actually feel like I'm working for them. I'm matching them with the people that need them.
Yes, I love that progression.
You're herbal matchmaker.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can I ask you a couple like practical questions about your practice? So you're, you know, a self-sufficient herbalist, you're growing or making your own medicine out of things that you gather. How do you balance like the quantities and like the herbs that you have versus like the clients? How many clients do you have that you can support? You know, I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. So recently I was seeing a lot more patients than I do right now. I mean, I'm still full time and I'm still very busy, but I was squeezing in lots of people and it was just such a lot, you know, and I wasn't allocating any specific time for my growing. My growing was like my relaxation time. So it would be at the weekends or in the evenings. And I just reached a point, I suppose, I think writing this recent book kind of made me realize, like, hang on, you know, you're not, you might think you're a superwoman, but you're not, you know. So I have made a bit more space so that I can just really have at least a day a week just growing and making medicines and being, I think the other part of that is having alone time with the herbs, because otherwise, you know, if you're always teaching or you're always seeing patients, you just don't get that time to just be with your own reflections, you know. And yeah, I mean, I absolutely love people or I wouldn't be in this job, but I also really love my own company.
Yes.
Well, no, but I like just being calm and being with the herbs. So I think, so that's part of it. And I think in terms of the amounts, if you are prescribing in this holistic way, mm-hmm. your need for quantities of herbs goes down because people are getting better and they don't need it anymore. So if I had lots of people like the patient I was talking about, you know, I'd be churning out, making capsules all day long. Yeah. To sell them to all these people that had become reliant on them. And I'm very, really firm on, I don't want to create dependence. I want people to get better. And I'm so happy when people get better. So, yeah, so I think it's difficult, isn't it? Sometimes there's going to be bigger quantities than others, and you never know which herbs are going to be needed. But what I do on a kind of practical level, if that's what you really want to get to, is that I harvest my herbs and dry them in a way that they are so good quality because they're small batch dried, and they will then last for well over a year, like 2 years, 3 years. So in my herb store at the back, which is all dark and the herbs are stored in tight boxes, food grade boxes, And they, some of them, you know, the roots and things will, might sometimes be 4 years old, and they're really fine. You know, really, that Angelica, for example, I know that's going to last. You can tell straight away if something's still vibrant.
Absolutely.
So the fact that things have a much longer shelf life, so aerial parts, like, say, agrimony, that's definitely good for 2 years. Definitely. Mm-hmm. I would never just throw it away. Oh, it's old, it needs to be thrown away. I will check, you know. Mm-hmm. And that means you have a lot more leeway. So if every year I make a harvest of something, so at the moment, lime blossom, linden.
Oh.
Last year I went crazy harvesting. It was a really big crop. Mm-hmm. And I had the time, and it was the right time. Sometimes I don't, sometimes the weather's wet. So I gathered a lot. And I've, as it happens, I haven't prescribed too much of it, you know, so I've still got plenty. So this year I'll probably just only make a little harvest, just for, you know, to take a photo and, you know, enjoy it. But yeah. you can kind of vary what you do. And then there is other things, like, for example, what was I doing the other day? There was something that I was really freaking out because I was really low on. I think, well, catmint I was really low on. And so I was like, oh, I'm going to have to harvest quite a lot of that. And it's just like a kind of movable feast of what you need, what you don't need. And sometimes it doesn't work out. And sometimes I have to buy stuff, you know, but I try not to. And it generally works out. And it's so often a hawthorn blossom. I was down to the last double handful in my store, and I was really, because I have a lot of people taking hawthorn capsules, and that actually is the exception to my stringent sort of rule about, not, you know, I'm not going to supply people with capsules. There are people that I supply with hawthorn capsules because it's keeping them alive, and yeah. I'm okay about that, because that hawthorn is doing a great job and it's appreciated. You know, I've got a patient with chronic congestive heart failure. Mm-hmm. And he came to me when he'd been given 18 months to live, and he came to me with the objective of staying alive a bit longer. Mm. And that was about 5 years ago, and he's doing all right, but I'm not going to say to him, I'm not giving you your hawthorn caps. So I had this double handful left of dried blossoms. I was like, oh, is it going to be okay? And then it's always seems to be okay, you know, the flowers just come out at the right time, and it is like stock control as well. You're sort of thinking, you know, make sure I maybe next year I need to gather a bit more because it was a bit tight.
Totally, yes.
But you learn what you need. You learn.
Yeah. Similar, last year we didn't have a great hawthorn harvest. We actually had COVID during the hawthorn bloom, and want to do that. And this year, the hawthorn is just magnificent. It's coming in so beautifully. We already made some hawthorn flower tincture. I'm going to gather more to try. So it's fantastic.
Yeah. I think, you know, if I can, I try to harvest a bit more than I need so that I have that buffer.
Yeah.
Because then the following year, rather than waste it, the following year, I'll think, no, I'll just harvest less. But you just always have that little bit extra to play with if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you dry your herbs to keep the potency so well?
Dance with the harvesting.
Yeah. So
the first thing that affects potency is, apart from obviously growing herbs beautifully, which I'm sure you do, but, you know, as soon as you pick them, they start to deteriorate. And so the other thing that happens is if they are bruised, they will lose some of their qualities. There will be a lesser quality. So what I do is I try to lay the herbs out in a single-ish layer within 30 minutes to an hour of picking and try to handle them gently. You know, so for example, if you're taking mint leaves off a stalk, I've seen people do that with a colander, like pulling that. I've seen that bruises them, so you're losing far more aromatics. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look, you know, I'm a bit bit of a fuss pot about it, because I really, you know, I've seen the difference. I didn't really realize how much of a difference there was, in a way, because I don't buy in stuff much these right. days, so I don't compare it. But I had a group of herbalists that came and we had a bit of a gathering, and I passed around, somebody said something like, oh, can we see what your dried herbs are like? And I will answer, you want to know how I dry them, but I'm still on that. But I passed around this peppermint box, and these were herbalists who work with herbs every day. And they were smelling this peppermint and they're like, this is incredible. And I think that it must be really different from bought in peppermint for their reaction to be like that.
Yeah.
Some of the things like cramp bark, it's just so different when you harvest it yourself. But we're still on to how to do it. So the first thing is to not leave them in a basket turning to compost.
Right.
Like straight away, lay them out, let them breathe, and do it gently. And if you need to, you know, try to just snip them off the stem instead of, you know, do that. I mean, I do that with rosemary, to be fair, because it's a bit tougher. But
yeah. You do that when it's dry, more like dry them off.
Yeah, you can, when it's dry, you can go for it, exactly. So I lay them out, and then I use a series of dehydrators. I just have like domestic ones. I actually use the Lay Kip Filter Pro, and I'm not on any kickback, so but I've sort of got into using that one because I have loads of spare trays from ones that wore out in the past, and I kept the trays. So I've got all this system where I can lay stuff out and then just put onto the dehydrator when it's ready. And it's just, you know, I have loads of those trays. So it makes sense for me to have this same system.
Yeah, that's really cool.
It really works well. And the other thing is, people often say to me, oh, but you know, why do I need to get a dehydrator? And I would say, you don't, you know, you don't necessarily need to have a dehydrator, but here, especially in the UK, you know, it is quite high humidity.
Right.
Dry things passively up to a certain point, but you probably need to finish them off so that you can put them into storage. And the other thing is that if you have loads of space available to you, you could have trays everywhere and stuff could really dry. But here, I've only got a small clinic, and it just gets covered in trays. So I need to get them into the dehydrator just to make space for the next crop. So for me, the dehydrators are really helpful in a high humidity environment, but I'm not saying they are essential for everyone. If you live somewhere with plenty of space and you've got a dry, low humidity environment, go for it, you know, do it passively, it's fine.
Yeah, also one of the things that I've got on my list, a solar dehydrator. But you know, it takes a little bit of building expertise to make one, but you can do it, you know, without electricity. But we use the regular electric dehydrators right now mostly.
Yeah,
to crisp them up.
Laying everything out and then crisping it and doing a little finish off in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really, because there's nothing worse than putting something into storage and then you find like, oh no, it's gone. Like, it's just so gutting.
So sad. Totally.
Oh, it doesn't happen very often, but when it does, I just feel so guilty.
Yeah, I know, me too.
Yeah. it's happened to me before.
Yeah. Started doing like smaller batches too of storage, rather than like saying like last week I have a big bag of calendula I did, and then this week I add my calendula to that same bag to top it off. Now I just do like separate batches too, because every once in a while you can ruin the ones that you did last week perfectly. So,
Well, I have a bit of a system now, because I agree, like, especially with calendula, it's really difficult to know that it's properly dry because of those green calyces, and they're just waiting
to
reabsorb moisture or to spread their moisture out. But what I do is I have a lot of small boxes. So I have quarantine boxes.
Nice.
And so I'll harvest the next batch of calendula and dry it and think that's fine, but it stays in its separate box for about a month. And then if all is well, it can go into the big box, because otherwise you just got millions of boxes.
That's so smart. The quarantine boxes. Perfect solution to that. There's one plant that we can't really grow out here that I've seen you write about before, and it's the European mistletoe. And I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit about that and about the uses and lore and things like that.
Definitely. Awesome. I absolutely love mistletoe, and I'm so lucky living in Somerset because there is a lot of European mistletoe around. So this is, just to make sure we don't get confused, this is Viscum album. And it's not, I've written a little note so I don't get the Latin name wrong. Phorodendron lucarpum is the American mistletoe, and that's not okay. It's toxic, my understanding is, although I don't think I've ever actually seen any in real life.
That's the only one I've seen.
Yeah.
In the south, you'll find it a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. But here in Somerset, there are all these, it's just like a complete globe in the winter. You've got these leafless trees and there's these green globes, and you can really understand how druids and people would see this in the middle of winter on these deciduous trees, that these living globes that are off the ground. I mean, of course it's magical, isn't it? I mean, how amazing is that? And the Latin name Viscum means sticky, like viscous, and mistletoe was believed to be, the berries were believed to be drops of semen from the cosmic bull when it was impregnating the goddess, the earth goddess. So definitely to do with fertility. But in my practice, I work with mistletoe mostly as a sedative and a hypotensive, and to help people sleep, you know, if they're not sleeping well. And it really is great. But I just would love to share with you this amazing little thing about the berries. Yes. On the magical level. Mm-hmm. So it's actually not really fair for you guys, because you won't be able to see a berry in real life. But on the European mistletoe berry, there's a white berry, and at the base there's like a little black dot, and it has four semicircles around the dot, so kind of like equidistant, and there's this little dot in the middle. And the dot in the center, the dot in the center is like the all-encompassing whole. And the four semicircles around it represent the mystical cities of the fairy kingdom, which is called Side, which is Side. Mm-hmm. And I just love this. And basically the northern semicircle is to represent the city of Phalias, and the southern is Phineas, and the western is Murias, and the east is Gorias. And I just think it's just, to me, it's like a mandala, you know, that there's this idea of the different directions being different characters. And I'm afraid I don't know more about these cities. There's probably people listening that will know more about it. But I just love these traditions, and it's just so magical to think that we've got this mandala in the berry of a very sacred plant that grows between earth and air. And oh, just love it. And just before Christmas, at the end of last year, I was going on a walk in an area that I hadn't walked in before. Mm-hmm. And I was following a river, and I came around a bend, and there's this hawthorn tree with a mass of mistletoe that was at eye level. And usually, you know, you're kind of looking up and you're thinking, oh, I got to wait till there's a storm or something before I can see it. But this one, I could just sit with it, and it was just right there. I didn't need to actually pick any, I didn't ask it, because I had loads that had come down in a storm. So my stocks of European mistletoe are really good. But just to be able to sit there and look at the berries and look at the plant, it was totally magical.
So on a hawthorn. Yes, and on a hawthorn, no less.
Exactly. It was just a great hangout.
That's so special. Sometimes we follow these paths right to where we need to be to see this amazing, you know, gift of nature.
Totally.
That's so cool. Thank you so much for telling us about mistletoe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would love to hear too about your new book, Working Herbal Dispensary. So you have 108 herbs in this book. What else have you included in it? And how do you choose those 108 herbs? Just tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to, the rationale for writing the book, I suppose, was that when I was studying Western herbal medicine, I like to have things, it may not sound like it, but I do like to have things kind of organized, especially when I'm learning. And I decided when I was learning Materia Medica that I was going to make flashcards. And, you know, and they were going to have like color coded edges for like all the diuretics were going to be one color and all the nervines were going to be another color. And I had great fun making all these flashcards and drawing a little drawing of the herb and writing their key actions and stuff. But I soon realized that my system was deeply flawed because it's just not easy to say, yeah, that's a diuretic. That's a nervine, that's a digestive. And it was just not tidy. And I was like, oh no, I've got to put a purple edge and a yellow edge and a blue edge. I couldn't make it tidy and just learn about it. And then I realized that that's the whole point. You know, you can't do that with herbs. You can sort of learn about them in that way to start with, but you realize like, no, they cannot be put in a box. You can't do that. You really need to kind of just get to know them, and that takes a long time. And so I felt the other thing that I noticed is that there is a bit of a tendency for people when they're learning about herbs to view them in terms of like the constituents they contain and the conditions that they treat. And right. I understand that, like, yeah, look, that's an important step in learning about them. But whenever people ask me on Instagram, you know, if I do a photo of something and they say, oh, well, how do you use it? Well, that is a question that just brain meltdown, because I'm thinking like, yeah, it's a perfectly reasonable question, you know. Yes, how do you use it? I really get that you want to know, you know, but I'm thinking, well, I don't want to make a simple one-liner, you know, like it's good for cystitis, because that would disrespect the herb. You know, I need to write a whole massive essay about it. And also, it's not as simple as that. If I did say, yeah, treat cystitis, you're thinking, well, that it's not all it is. It's like, if would you say about your best friend, it's like, yeah, she's blonde. Like, you wouldn't, would you? You know, so anyway, I tied myself in knots about, you know, how was I gonna get around this. And I thought, well, I think the best thing to do is to actually write about them in a way that hopefully brings together their character, and it still talks about, you know, the conditions they're good for, and some of them, you know, I don't hugely talk about the constituents, but it, obviously it's part of it. But I also talk about, yeah, their physiological properties, and each herb that I talk about, I try to have like a phrase that helps you really get to the heart of it. So for example, I'm you know, do you know what, I haven't even got a copy of my book because it's, I haven't seen one yet, so I'm just doing this from memory, and it might not be the exact words I use, but I think so. With cramp bark, at the top I have like, you know, cramp bark, viburnum oculus, and then underneath that there's like the key phrase to help you remember it. Mm-hmm. And it's, cramp bark is the master of letting go. And the reason, so that's encompassing, you know, obviously it's got all of its physiological aspects of helping to relieve spasm and, you know, and helping with high blood pressure, because even the cardiovascular system, it can help it to relax. But also on an energetic level, you know, when people are really quite rigid, mm-hmm, in their attitudes and they have a very strict regime, you know, cramp bark can really make an astounding difference. I had a lady that when I was doing her consultation, I asked her about her food, and she said, well, on Mondays we have this, on Tuesdays this, like, and it was really, everything about her life was very rigid and the same, and she had high blood pressure. And I was thinking to myself, well, I don't know about the other herbs, but she's definitely having viburnum mopulus, a cramp bar, that's for sure. And over the months, as her blood pressure came down, she got a bit more flexible. And I knew that, I just knew the cramp bar had been really effective. The blood pressure was, it was so lovely to see her blossoming and her blood pressure coming down. And then she came in, and this is a lady in her mid-70s, and she told me, I never mentioned this to you, but I always wanted to be a racing driver. And so I've booked an experience day at the local racetrack so that I can have a go.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Cramp bark to the rescue. But anyway, so it's kind of like describing the herbs and also the magical aspects sometimes. And I think as well, I think it is quite revealing for me to be able to describe a few case studies that show about the herbs working on different levels at the same time. And I think I really wanted to include recipes so that if people are really keen on herbs, but they're not like in a qualified sort of, or whatever you want to call it, like a professional setting. Yeah. But it's, herbs are for everyone. So I've actually included all these recipes for the home apothecary so that people can build their own apothecary and understand how they can prescribe these for their family and for themselves. And yeah, it was really fun. But I always have to work in 108s because it's a Tibetan sacred number.
Oh,
I just think like, yeah. So my first book had 108 herbs in the glossary about how to dry them. And then the second book, I was thinking like, 108 is an awful lot to write about in that degree of detail. So maybe, you know, maybe I should do 54 and then like later on, you know, do that. Because I was thinking, honestly, it's a lot to write about. And I said to my husband, like, yeah, I just think 108, although I like, it really appeals to me to do 108, maybe I should just do 54 because it's just going to be such a huge project otherwise. And he said, can't possibly just do 54. It would be really rubbish to only do 54. Because people feel like, why should I have to buy volume 2? He said, you must do 108.
You must.
And I'll tell you, there were times during when I wrote that where I was really cursing him.
But he's right, right?
He's absolutely right. And I'm so grateful because I pushed on through.
Yeah.
And even though I'm sort of slightly saying, you know, it was a huge undertaking, it was so difficult to choose the 100. It was like, who's going to make it into the final cut, you know? Yeah. But in the end, I think I had to choose perhaps the 108 that I felt that I knew, for me, I knew the best. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing. Like, I was quite, in some respects, a little bit, you know, I was quite nervous about writing it in a way, because my experience of herbs is going to be different from other people's. And I didn't want to come across as like, yeah, this is what this one does, and this is how you should look at it. It's more like, I want it to be like, look, This is my understanding of this herb, and I hope that it helps give some food for thought and, you know, maybe some inspiration, or maybe it's not, you know, like, people are going to work in different ways, aren't they? So it's kind of like just a sharing of how I view them. Yeah, and I'm sure that there's a lot of commonalities with what other people view, but also, you know, when we work with a herb, it is very personal, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I think, yeah, it was quite a relief when I finished it, I can tell you. And it's going to be amazing when I actually see a copy, if I can see it's real.
I'm so excited for you. I saw that Ollie from Aeon Books sent you a picture of the copy on Instagram, and I was so excited for you.
Yeah, it's real. It's just I haven't felt it yet.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to get my copy at the same time as everyone else. So,
okay. Cool. So if folks want to order your book or they want to find you, you know, online, you have Instagram and Patreon. Do you want to tell folks how they can get in touch and how they can pre-order or order?
So the best thing to do, well, firstly, I'm on Instagram as at Mirobalan Clinic, and I'm also on there as at Lucy Jones Herbal with underscores between them. And in my bio, in both of those, there is a link to order from Eon. And at the moment, there is a discount code that you can use. And I think it's very imminent. I don't know if that's still going to be going by the time this comes out, so I don't want to disappoint people. So go on the links, or you can order directly from Eon. And if you are in different countries, and obviously lots of people in the US, there is a US distributor, but I'm not sure of the details of that because there's a new distributor coming on in the US. So I will share in my bio on Instagram. Sorry to be a bit vague, but I sort of just let Eon deal with all of that side of it. And I also do have a Patreon, which is linked in my bios on there as well. And it's so much fun to have an online community. I set it up when it was the pandemic, and I was a bit worried that nobody was going to come to my clinic anymore, and I was going to like, oh no, what am I going to do? And so I set up the Patreon because so many people also ask if they can come and study with me. So I thought, well, this is perfect to be online. And it's just become so much more than that. It's like a family, and it's just so fun. And we have Q&As, and like I learn so much from my patrons. And it's just nice because it can be a bit isolating working alone, and then I have my, like, every 3 weeks or so we all have a get together, and I just so look forward to it. It's brilliant.
That's awesome.
People, it's not just for my benefit. I mean, people do say they enjoy it as well.
Well, yeah, of course they do. Cool. Any other things that you're excited about, or what's coming up for you?
Well, at the moment, I am doing quite a few talks and conferences and things. And I have got other things bubbling up, but I'm not quite ready to. I'm going to be a bit mysterious about that.
Oh, excellent.
There is a lot of people who are asking me to do another tier on Patreon. So I had like the self-sufficient herbal tier where we talk about growing and gathering and drying and stuff like that. And then there's the pro tier for people that are actually seeing patients, because there's a whole another layer of issues. It's quite handy to talk about, like, you know, what do you do if people are late paying, or what do you do, you know, like all that sort of practical thing about running a practice. And I really wanted to have this kind of like a layer that, or a tier that's like for the home herbalist, so we could talk about what conditions we, you know, how we can treat them and all that kind of thing. And I've been meaning to do that for a long time, but I've realized there's a few, it's not the best platform in my view for sharing that kind of info, I think. And so I thought, actually, I want to do it properly to do the herbs justice. And to not get lured into that trap of talking about this is what you use for this condition, you know. So I'm actually creating a home herbalist's course that I will be launching, and I was trying to launch it kind of around about before the end of this year, but honestly, with writing about these 108 herbs, I need to take a bit of a break, thanks to my husband's input. So I'm kind of just taking it a bit easy, but that will be something that comes out.
That's so exciting. I bet so many of our listeners would love to study with you and to learn more about that. Cool.
It's lovely interacting with people. We all learn so much from each other, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so cool with the internet that we can have this global community of people from all over who are on similar wavelengths with the love range, you know.
It's great.
Well, thank you so much, Lucy. This has been so fantastic. I really appreciate you joining us on the podcast, and thanks for all of your stories and wisdom.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
It's been super fun.